Welcome to Leaving Erinsborough, the Neighbours Rewatch podcast from the very beginning. I'm Sarah Gibbs. Don't know what I do anymore. I guess I write stuff sometimes. And I am here with my very dear friend and co-host.
Hello, I'm Rachel Krieger. I'm a comedian and writer and quite often sleeper on the couch at the moment. That's, I think, my main hobby.
Oh, gosh. Did you make out with, did you make love to Melanie?
God forbid. No, do you know what it is? I was talking to someone about this yesterday. When we moved into this house a couple of years ago, it's a terrible house full of nightmares. We don't have enough time on this podcast to hear about the dramas of the house, but I didn't want to spend like loads of money on getting furniture for it because it's rented and we were hoping we'd be able to leave it straight away. Here we are nearly 3 years later, not able to move. But on Amazon Marketplace or no, Facebook Marketplace, other marketplaces are available. Go to your nearest marketplace. I got an L-shaped couch, which was always like one of my dreams. But obviously I got it for, you know, three buttons, a tiny little toy horse, and a two pence piece or whatever's in that Cadbury's advert. And it's like, I don't know if it's got crack in it or something. I don't know what, like the drug, as in not a crack. It's so comfortable. If you sit on it, it sends you to sleep. It's like the poppy field in Wizard of Oz.
It's like Nicolette's napping couch.
It's like Nicolette's napping couch. That's what I'm going to call it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, better than Therese and Paul's sex couch. So yeah,
everything about that
on a scale of couches.
You're coming into this podcast now, dear listeners, expecting us to talk about the old Neighbours, but we have just spent 10 minutes microanalyzing contemporary Neighbours and discussing the weirdness of doing this podcast while that's on. So on the same day, you're watching Paul at two different ages being identical, even the hair.
It's quite, yeah. This is a man who was committed to his bit.
Yeah. That hair, I mean, there must be, you know, like in, I don't know if you've seen I Am Legend, the film, and they realise that his blood contains whatever it is that keeps people human and alive.
I have not.
But I think Paul's hair.
No, I don't need to.
Paul's hair defies ageing. So really, instead of like hyaluronic acids or whatever they advertise on television, I don't know, I don't use that stuff. But, you know, microdermabrasion or Botox, if they could extract whatever has stayed in Paul's hair, we could all stay young forever.
I'll tell you what it is. It's the portrait. It's Paul's portrait in an attic somewhere. It's been in an attic. Ned just found it, claimed it.
Wow.
That's my theory.
That's deep.
What is it? Dorian Gray? I don't know. I was getting mixed up with Benjamin Button. I've seen or read neither. I'm completely ignorant. Let's move on from my complete lack of knowledge of anything.
About Paul this morning, really, because, you know, I watched an episode of Old Neighbours, like the last one for today, and then I watched Current Neighbours, and he was reversing his age. It was so weird.
That is very weird. Oh, so I watched these episodes about a week ago, and I have a memory like a sieve, so this should be interesting. I'm hoping you remember, you've retained more about these episodes than I have, but shall we kick off with Charlene's baby?
We should kick off with that. And just by the way, in terms of retention, I watched them more recently than you. I can't guarantee any retention because some of them were watched on that couch. But I have got 5 pages of notes, so I won't.
Fantastic.
We'll see if I remember what any of them mean. But yeah, Charlene and her baby. I thought Madge's reaction to the baby was alarmingly and amazingly mild.
Yeah. Madge was a trooper.
But I mean, you'd have thought there'd be some kind of initial meltdown.
She must on some level know that it's bullshit. Right? That like somebody would have noticed or mentioned a pregnancy and a birth, and you know, like it's such a cock and bull story. And then like conveniently Fred not being available to verify it. It's all just nonsense.
Yeah. I mean, I'd forgotten this storyline completely, by the way, but as soon as I saw her with that baby, I was like, that's her brother. I just thought immediately, oh, that's her brother, or that's her sister, or that's something, or that's like, the dad's had a fling with someone and now she's looking after that baby.
Okay, because I thought, because I know she's got the brother in prison, and for the first bit of last fortnight, I thought that that Henry was being released and staying somewhere and she was bringing him food or something.
Oh.
And then when the baby was involved, I thought maybe Henry had knocked someone up.
Ah, so yeah, I agree with you that I initially thought it was Henry in a safe house type thing.
Yeah.
And then I thought, no, it's I don't know why I thought it's a baby. But anyway, the baby wasn't a shock. Although I have forgotten about it. But yeah, I did think it would be something to do with her dad. But I didn't think it would be that the ex-wife, not ex-wife, that his wife was still knocking about.
Yeah, so rewinding a bit, Scott dumps Charlene for having a baby and lying about it. I think honestly it's more about the lying than it is about the baby. To give Scott credit he probably doesn't deserve, because he's been covering for her for weeks and she hasn't been confiding in him and he feels hurt.
Yeah.
And for once, that's kind of understandable, I guess.
But I think it's also because you can't have, like, babies are naturally quite whiny because they can't talk, and you couldn't have two whining voices in all the scenes together of that baby and Scott. Oh, my God. The whining.
There's only room for one baby in Charlene's life.
And Charlene, it's, I mean, that's all he does all the time. His acting, I don't remember his acting being so terrible. Like, how did I not notice that?
Oh, sorry, Mr. Donovan, if you're listening.
And if you want to come
sure
on, if you want to come on the podcast, I won't
complain. Explain yourself.
I won't complain about your voice in that episode.
What a generous offer. We can't give you any money, but Rachel will refrain from calling you a whiny little baby to your face.
I mean, I actually
give us a call.
I'm not even sure I can make that promise.
I'm sure he's not listening to this podcast. So the dumping doesn't last very long because Scott has 5 minutes to think about it and is like, actually, no, I'm like, I've decided to be half decent this fortnight, which, good on him. We like to see growth, I guess. I don't care. So Madge is trying to conceal the baby for the time being because, you know, young unwed mother, it's the 1980s, and in Madge's head, it's the 1950s.
Yeah.
And Charlene immediately tells Mrs. Mangle about the baby, so that doesn't last very long.
I thought that was quite clever because if you want to, well, there was a few tellings of people. First of all, I think, hang on, let me look at my little notes. I enjoyed it when she said to Charlene, you know, the rest street won't have to know, and Madge went like, no, they will all find out, and she went, well, the rest of the street can mind their own business, like that has ever happened. No one's ever mind their own business. But I thought it was quite clever for Madge to confide in Eileen, because that is a good plot device for getting information out, having her and Mrs. Mangle know about the baby initially. Then you don't have to do anything else. You don't have to put it on, you don't have to do a WhatsApp blast, you don't have to do you know, put it on your Facebook status or anything. You just tell those two, everyone will find out. Also, Eileen was talking to Manch for about 20 minutes before she noticed there was a baby there, which I thought was very funny.
Well, she's very self-absorbed, bless her.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of The Simpsons when Patty and Selma call Aronson and Zukowski to tell them that Marge is pregnant. Yeah. And you think they're doing an A to Z, and the gag is Aronson and Zukowski are the biggest gossips in town.
Yeah, nice one. That is true.
Yeah.
I think, like, and also initially Madge sort of is suggesting to her to get rid of it, which was a bit of a weird conversation. So she's sort of saying, you know, are you sure you want to keep it? You know, there's other things we can do. And then Helen says,
a bit late for that.
I was going to say, and then Helen, I think just into the care system. And then Helen's like, Madge, can you afford to look after the baby? And then Madge's like, oh, I don't know what to do for the best. It's her grandson. It's her grandson. Do you know what I mean? And I mean, at that point, as far as she knows, it's her grandson. So do you want to get rid of it? It seems a really weird response when you've been sort of so mellow about it. And then, or because of financial reasons, you just pass it on to somebody else, which, I mean, on the other hand, is that what, someone had done that? What was that storyline right at the beginning with Helen and, oh, Julie?
Oh.
Wasn't there some storyline at the beginning?
What's that?
No, not Julie.
Oh, no, Rosemary.
Yeah. They're like the same person. But yeah, Rosemary, you know, and it's all about if there's not enough money, you just pass the baby on. I don't know, it was very weird, but it's her grandson. And then I've written underneath that, by the way, Scott's whiny voice.
Oh dear. I mean, that's an evergreen note, really. I enjoyed how Madge consulted Tom and Shane about whether or not the baby could stay. Yeah. And their examination of that baby, it was like they'd never seen a baby before.
Yeah.
They were inspecting it like it was a car they were gonna buy. They were like leaning down, like to
raising it up, you know, on a crouching ramp, sitting underneath it on a board which has got wheels on.
It was really, really such a strange reaction to a human baby. Like, what is this? Mm. I don't understand. And they didn't seem to also anticipate that babies cry. They were very put out by that.
Yes.
They were like, when we said this baby could stay, it was quite where we inspected it. It wasn't making that noise.
Yeah, I wrote the same thing. So they seemed very confused by the fact that baby cries. But I'm pretty sure when they were babies, they were not silent.
No, they're still not silent, and they're still babies. All the men on Ramsey Street are babies. So Charlene comes clean to Scott that it's not her baby. In the meantime, Madge is fully bonding with this baby in full grandma mode, more like in full mum mode, because Charlene's just like, here's my baby, I'm going out. Yeah. Like, it's not good to the accent, it's terrible. But like, bye, good luck with the baby. And this is, even before we know whose it is, this is the cruelest shit I have ever seen anyone do to another human being, to say, this is your grandchild, here, bond, take care of it, and knowing it's not. But then knowing that not only is it not her grandchild, but it's Fred and Susan's baby, and that she's now cleaning up the messes of her awful ex-husband, who has only very recently had sex with her again, left her very traumatized.
And taken her money and her share of the business.
And now she's holding his love child.
Right. I mean, my thoughts on this were, first of all, Scott and Charlene getting back together. It's so toxic. He is so toxic to her. He's like encouraging her to tell the truth because he can't stand seeing her down. Not because it's the right thing to do or make her. It was because she's not smiling enough, love. You know, you look so much more prettier when you smile, love. So it would make his life better if she wasn't so down about, you know, having to go, you know, keep this a secret. But also, when I saw that little scene with Madge and Charlene and the bonding and the baby and all of that, what I do is, when I see things that seem too perfect, in my head, I call them an episode of Casualty. And let me tell you why. Because in the television programme Casualty, at the beginning, if anything is happening to a family that is too lovely, then you just know it's going to implode, right? So the dad will say, oh, the Christmas lights are almost perfect. The tree is perfect. The Christmas pudding is perfect. You're perfect, my darling. Our children are perfect. But I think if we just had one more bulb on that string of lights across the roof, everything would be perfect. And then you know he's off that ladder and concussed in about 10 seconds, right? You know it's coming. If everyone's sitting around a table saying, oh, this dinner is so delightful, I'm so happy to be here with all of you, my best friends, we've all reunited after 100 years separated by land and sea, and here we are finally all back together, you know somebody is choking on a chicken bone, right? So as soon as there was this scene, I was like, any thoughts in my mind that I had in the back of my mind that maybe this was Charlene's baby, or that this was going to have like some kind of positive outcome, were stricken by the perfectness of everyone getting on and bonding. Absolutely not. Episode of Casualty moment.
Totally. Because the only way it would have been not unforgivable is if it was Henry's baby and still her grandchild.
Completely.
That is the only way that situation would have been like, okay, she lied, but she hasn't. The emotional stakes for Madge are not any different in that situation. It's still her grandchild. Mm. Maybe she's mad at Henry, whatever, but it's the bond is the same. But to give her Fred and Susan's baby, and what a horrific, nasty, it's so beyond a prank. I know she thought she was doing the right thing for Susan, but I don't know how a relationship recovers from that, to be honest. Yeah. Like, wouldn't you always be like, remember the time that my daughter told me this was my grandchild and it was actually my ex-husband and his new wife's baby? And it's terrible, 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 terrible.
By the way, that was a laugh, by the way. I wasn't suggesting anybody was a hoe.
No. Nobody is a hoe. This is a progressive podcast. However, so the baby is Susan. Susan is suffering from some mystery illness.
Yeah, so this is very interesting because, you know, sometimes when there's like I'm very deep today. There's like a philosophy about life that in terms of history and the world and the way we function, that it's not a straight line. It's a kind of spiral because at periods of time you revisit certain aspects of history recur in your time, right? Are you with me? If it's on a spiral, so we're closer to one war than another war. No, hang on, that doesn't make sense. What I'm saying is that things recur and you think, oh wow, if you look back at history at a similar period, like with the pandemic, right?
Sure.
So why am I talking about this? What had you just said? Oh my god, my
brain. No idea. Susan's mystery illness.
Oh yeah, Susan's mystery illness, because what is the big conversation right now going on in this country? Kate Middleton's mystery illness. That's all I could think of was, look at that. It's like
I'd written that down. But then I was like, oh no, what if Kate Middleton's really ill?
No, and
I make a joke about it on the podcast. And then it turns out it's something terrible. And not just Susan sort of having a dizzy spell every now and then and needing to lie down in Madge's spare room.
Well, I mean, all I can say is that I immediately thought that we are never did you imagine something would be so contemporary as Susan's mysterious illness, and that being the biggest,
yes.
I mean, it's ridiculous the way it's being discussed right now. But also we have Susan's incredible faint coming up, so I'm just like,
yeah.
I'm just like the scene. I know we haven't got to it yet, we're going to soon, but I think if we saw Kate Middleton do like a proper dramatic faint, the newspapers would, I mean, they wouldn't know how to cope with themselves. What would they do? They'd be so excited, which is terrible. She's a human person.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think it's less about, I don't know, for the newspapers, it's probably about the illness. For everyone else, it's more about what the fuck is going on with the PR handling of this.
Yeah.
Which is really, really bizarre at best.
It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it's odd. Anyway, this is not the royal family, the British royal family podcast. But yes, it's very, very odd. Anyway, we're all talking about it. We're all thinking about it. God knows by the time this comes out, what will be going on? Like whether we'll have a like
maybe the monarchy cyborg will have been Kate. Overthrown.
Yeah, France will have invaded. They sense weakness. Anyway. So Susan shows up and is like, can I have my baby back? And
oh,
everyone's
reasonable.
Like, no,
you're...
No. And everyone's like, no, you're too sick. We don't know what with, because apparently they didn't quite finish writing this episode. It's a bit like when I need a character to be ill, but I haven't quite done my research yet. So I'm just like, TK, illness. Like, I'll come back to that. I'll figure that out later. But they just didn't, you know, TK in writer's terms is when you put something in a script or a manuscript where you need to come back to it, and TK is not a thing that appears organically in the English language. So if you want to search for things that you have to fill in, you put TK, whatever it is.
I'm just saying we're having fun and we're learning, so that's
yes.
Good.
Anyway, TK illness. Susan has TK illness and she wants her baby back, and everyone's like, no, you can't. And so then she comes back in, she gives Charlene like 5 seconds to explain to Madge what's going on before she bursts in and is like, give me my baby. So then
there's this amazing feint where she kind of does like in Wayne's World when they want to like go back in time or like be in a different place or whatever, they do their diddle-a-doo, diddle-a-doo, and they do kind of wobbly hands. She kind of does like a wobbly body. She sort of sinuously, I don't know how you pronounce the word.
Sinuously.
Kind of does a kind of snake move with her whole body and then collapses to the floor. And she gives it 100%. There's no kind of holding back, you're dropping so that you don't bang yourself on the floor or anything. Like, she goes for it like a sack of flour. Unbelievable. A sack of flour? whatever. You understand? Yeah. You understand what I mean? She doesn't. You can't see there's a mattress there to catch her or anything because they didn't have health and safety in those days.
No.
She just like does a doodly
doo. No, she's dead. Yeah. That was her last acting role. R.I.P. Oh dear.
Nobody ever in this program calls an ambulance when someone hurts themselves. They never, their immediate thought is never, let's bring in a doctor. Why don't we just call an ambulance that might save that person? She collapses, they faff around her. Oh, mum, come and help me. Help me what? Help me sit next to Susan and worry about her. Call an ambulance.
Nobody, you don't need an ambulance. You've got Clive.
Well, they, it's a little while before they go, yeah, go next door and get Clive. First they have
Clive is a one-man ambulance.
But first they have to sit around her and be like, oh, no. Clive's out. Call an ambulance. If there's one.
No one in Ramsey Street is good in a crisis.
Mm, this is true.
Unfortunately.
Although they say Clive is, but I mean, that's because he's all they have. But they could have more if they called an ambulance. I'm just saying that there's options.
Yeah.
What if Clive's out with the sister of his dead girlfriend? What, you know, like he might be busy.
Yeah, I think at that point he's been, well, we'll get to that. So then Clive and what's her face? Charlene. What's her face?
The blonde one.
Yeah, Clive and Charlene are like, she has to stay in this house. For so there's no other options for this woman. She needs to live here now. And Charlene is at peak brat. And she's like, I'm going to move out if you don't put yourself in this emotionally harrowing situation.
Yeah, and Madge has, but Madge is attached to it. But it is still, I would say, just from a mitigation point of view, that Charlene's supposed to be, what, about 16 or 17 or something. And this is her baby brother, and she was sworn to secrecy and has been like trying to take care of this baby with a terribly ill mum for weeks and weeks, or years and years, as it felt like in the show. So however she's being cruel and selfish, she's being cruel and selfish with the teenage logic, and this is her brother. It's not a random baby.
No, but like brother, but, zero compassion for Madge in this situation. Just like, well, I'm sorry you're offended, but like, I'm sorry you feel that way, but I'm going to storm out unless you... And like, I get the teenage thing, but I still want to like wring her neck a little bit.
I hear you.
She's just, I'm coming at this. I'm old now. I'm getting to an age where I'm like completely, fully compassionate with Madge. Although like, I think it's really like quite progressive and important that like she was kind of calling Susan, she was quite slut shaming and blaming of Susan, who again, like when Susan puts her side of it forward and is like, no, he lied to me and I was young and vulnerable and he was in a position of power.
Yeah.
It's like, oh shit, Susan's a victim.
Yeah. But also that made me wonder for a minute about, I had a wonder when Charlene said the name of the baby, whether, you know, considering her closeness to her dad and the whole kissing her on the lips and sitting on her on his lap when he was around, yeah. I did wonder if this was a, it's my brother, but also my uncle, but also my, do you know what I mean? I did wonder.
No.
No, I did wonder if Fred was the dad, but it was Charlene's baby.
Oh, yeah, that's dark.
Yeah.
I don't know if neighbours would go there.
Well, they went there in a way because the next scene is Madge in church and hearing a I was just going to say a drosha, which is like a rabbinical sermon, but I just meant a sermon. And the sermon is about how Jesus forgave the harlot. And then she comes home and she's like, all right, Susan, you can stay.
That's terrible.
And in that analogy, just saying, Madge is Jesus.
Madge is very Christ-like in this episode.
She is. Oh, she's amazing in this.
Turns a lot of cheeks.
But that made me laugh so much. That might be, in all seriousness, one of my favourite neighbours moments of all time. It's Jesus. And remember, Jesus forgave the harlot. All right, Susan. You're on.
What a great cut. Smash cut to Susan.
Yeah. But also then, when Susan does her big confession later to Madge about Fred's coming on to her, you know, relentlessly, and then now he left her because she felt, after she found out he'd been fooling around. Was the fooling around with I'm just having such a neurodivergent about the word fooling. It feels really weird in my mouth. But was that when he had it off with Madge?
Oh.
Or was there?
No, I think this is another? I think Fred's success rate is inexplicably high in this universe.
No, that's fair. Yeah, he's got a catch.
It's got quite a hit rate for being Fred.
Well,
yes.
There you go. That was my query.
Yeah. So now we got this odd couple situation with Madge and Susan, and they're raising the baby together as sister wives, I guess. And Madge is fully committed. She's turning down job opportunities that she really wants in order to take care of Susan and this baby, which is a shame for her.
A shame for her, but it helps with the saintliness.
Yeah. Saint Madge, I guess they're preparing her for another saint that's going to enter the show at some point. I actually don't know when. I don't know what year he comes in or when, at what point they get together. But I do know that there is another certain tuba-playing saint who will arrive at some point, and she has to be a bride of Christ for him. So
yeah, keep herself that's, pure.
Yes, that seems to be what they're doing. Anyway, meanwhile, in the Ramsay household, Tom and Max have swapped houses behind Madge's back. I don't understand this arrangement. I don't care to understand it, but everyone's very upset about it, including Shane, who has apparently been disinherited. I don't know. Why wouldn't he just have a stake in the other house?
Presumably. It's a totally uninteresting and unimportant.
Yeah, whatever. Shane is a whiny little baby, like all the men on Ramsay Street. So the fortnight starts for Shane. He gets into an altercation in the pub where he's ordering a beer. He doesn't specify, nobody specifies at any point which beer they're ordering. A beer, please. They're only serving one beer at this pub.
Yeah, but it's maybe because they weren't allowed to advertise. But they could have made one up. They could have had, you know, like when you go to
Cocoa Pops.
But you know, like when, actually they do advertise. But that might be it though, Sarah. Maybe because they've got like a deal with Kellogg's now. So they're not allowed to advertise other brands, but they could have done like what's it called when you go to like microbreweries and they have IPAs and they're all called like funny things. So they could have had like a Lassiter Lion or whatever.
Yeah,
they could have done something.
Anything. TK beer.
TK beer. But why?
By the way, Kellogg's, if you're listening, you can't have Cocoa Hops. It's mine.
Cocoa Hops is very, very good.
Oh dear.
I really like that. Cocoa Hops. I want to think about that a lot today. The darts thing is very funny because initially Tom is like all the men, Tom and Alex and whoever, they're all mansplaining, but to other men about darts. It was a kind of delight as everyone was the expert. And they felt they knew more than other people because we've all witnessed those conversations. And
just burn the pub down while they're all there, to be honest.
It's just such a delight to not be the focus of the mansplaining and to watch them doing it at each other. And they can see how annoying it is, and yet they continue. And then this darts match becomes this darts challenge between Shane and this guy who looks like a preppy American from an 80s movie, but he's Australian.
Yeah, I've just called him Biff Dartsface. I know, but he did have a name and he referred to himself in the third person and I've completely forgotten what it is.
I probably wrote it somewhere, but I prefer Biff Dartsface, so let's keep that. But they then kind of organise this sort of match between each other, and it's exactly the same as in Greece. And the car race is like, I'll meet you at 3 o'clock, but I'm not free at 3 o'clock, but I will be free at 3 o'clock. Do you know what I mean? Like the whole thing. And
let me get my diary out.
Yeah, I was looking for.
Well, I have plans then. Oh, are you a chicken? No, I have plans.
I was trying to remember, what was her name? The girl who like starts the race for them and drops her sexy hanky.
I don't know, Lady Prize Face.
No, like in Greece, I can't believe you don't know. This is
what are they? Rizzo?
No, it wasn't her. It was like her, enemy.
Rizzo had an enemy. I haven't seen the film
in
many years.
Enemy. It's it's the one who wanted Danny, when he wants Sandy. Chacha Di Gregorio. So that's what I really wanted for the darts match, is I wanted Chacha de Gregorio. That pronunciation is so terrible in an Essex accent. I'm so sorry, Americans and anyone of the De Gregorio family. But yeah.
Apologies to the De Gregorio clan.
So I just wanted her to like be in front of the darts board, pull out a scarf from her cleavage or however she does it in Greece, and then drop it to the ground and then have to duck out of the way, because otherwise you'll get speared by a dart. But yeah, it was very interesting.
They are fighting to win a girl. I mean, they're fighting to win a bike, but they are fighting to win a girl prize.
Yeah, this is true. And then you've got Shane sort of shilling that he's not good at darts, and then losing, but then winning, and then losing, then winning.
The old switcheroo.
And then he wins a bike that's so bad that he's actually done them a favour by taking it off him. Biff Dart's face. I actually put, like, because there's different things that happen throughout, you know, darts is happening, then we go back to a different bit of story, then darts is happening, and then I did put in capital, you've got Mrs. Mangle threatening the family, they've got, it's the darts match in capital letters, because it was given so much prominence. It was like, it's the pancake toss. You know, some things
I preferred the pancake toss
instead of the darts spearage.
Oh dear.
And where did that cat come from? Suddenly there's a
cat,
there's a cat that disturbs Biff Dart's face's concentration. And
the least believable thing about all of this is, like, if a cat walked through my pub, or I was in the pub and a cat walked through, I'd be like, cat, oh my god, and I'd go and pet it. No one's petting this cat. No one's excited to see the cat.
And also,
no one is good appropriately reverent.
Have, like, loads of pubs have pub cats and pub dogs. Those are the best pubs.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, and this is not the best pub.
I'm marking.
They only have one beer.
They only have one beer. Cocoa Hops. We need to do an advert for Cocoa Hops. Cocoa Hops.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I'll get right on that. Oh dear, oh dear. So yeah, he wins the bike, and then later on in the fortnight, another biker girl shows up. Another girl prize face. I can't remember her name. Okay. But
her name is Patty.
Oh yeah, they keep calling her Paddy.
And I'm put here when she arrived, and I will fight anyone who disagrees with me on this. Mysterious bikers on TV are always unfailingly women.
Mm-hmm.
That is always
okay.
A fact.
Terminator.
Still a woman in some way. Is that a woman? I don't remember. I hate Terminator.
Schwarzenegger,
but is he a mysterious biker? Like, he's all covered up.
What he does is he steals the clothing of a biker person,
right? But I'm
so, like, he shows up naked, and then he becomes enclothed in biker gear.
I just hate that film and all the subsequent films, so I've blocked it from my memory. It's just too depressing. And really, look at the bin fire we're living in now. But. What I'm saying is, on a TV show, if you have people who are bikers and they're just whoever they are, and they're predominantly men, and there's a mysterious biker with their head covered up and all their hair tucked in, also true for someone climbing in through a window with their hair tucked into a hat. If there's someone mysterious wearing covering up-y clothing and with no hair showing, without a doubt, they have long hair and they are female. So... that's my pronouncement. That's number two of my three pronouncements, by the way. Thing one, casualty. Thing two, mysterious bikers always women. Do you want thing three now or at the end?
Oh, let's store it up.
Okay.
I will build up to it. Okay. It better be good now. There was so much pressure. Fantastic. So yeah, this biker girl shows up. She's a lady. Paul likes her. Clive likes her. Shane likes her. They get into a competition about who gets to win her. I don't care. Shane's leaving because he's mad about the house. And then he sleeps with her. And then Daphne walks in. Then Daphne's jealous, and she's like, "I'm not. I can't be jealous. I'm married, and marriage kills all your previous feelings." Right. That's how it works.
Well, my concern about biker girl Penny, I can't do accents, and Shane getting together is that they just would never have any money, because they'd have to spend it all on sunning and bleach.
Yes, that's true. They can't both be pretty.
No, and also their hair would be so flammable, like it could ignite each other.
Indeed. Oh, so yeah, now he's going off biking with her. Oh, she gets accused of thievery, then she's not, but that's part of a later plot line, so whatever.
She says to him, to Shane, you know, you need to be sure you want to go because freedom costs. And I wanted her to carry on, and right here is where you start paying in steps. What a missed opportunity to quote Fame.
Very, indeed. Maybe they couldn't get the rights. Or maybe they meant to write the rest of the line. They were going to look it up. TK Fame.
TK Fame. Or maybe Lydia Grant hadn't said that yet, because I don't remember when Fame, the series, came out in relation to Neighbours, the series.
Good point. I Googled it, but...
We're busy now.
Yes. Okay, so Clive and his dead fiance, because she's just the same person, they have a thing. She's like, I don't want anything serious. I just want to have fun. And he's like, marry me, because he lives on Ramsey Street and he can't have a normal healthy adult relationship. He comes on very strong. She's like, not sure about this.
It's unpleasantly strong,
actually. Yeah, and unfortunately,
and when they do their first kiss, I was desperate for him to like then pull away from her and go, wow, it's just like kissing your sister. That's what I thought he was going to say. And then he says to her, he feels like he's just come back from his honeymoon, which is like a bit gross. And then they're like, did we rush into it? Did we rush into this? And he's like, no, is there anything wrong in us finding comfort with each other? Let's get married. Oh, it's a lot.
She sensibly is like, this is a lot, I'm going to leave. She probably didn't need to go all the way to England, but she does.
You have to, and... I mean, to get away from Ramsey Street men, you have to like be, get away.
Put an ocean between you. By the way, is Zoe gone? Just dropping that in here randomly. Yeah. Where's Zoe? Wait, is she gone now?
She went off with that geezer, the funny accent geezer.
They were like, oh, we're just going to live down the road.
Yeah, but you
so
know,
we'll never see you again.
You've got to give them, how long has this been? 2 weeks.
Yeah,
gotta give them time to settle in.
Right. Okay. Whatever. We'll anyway, she leaves. Clive sad. The end. Meanwhile, in Clive's family, there is a terrible crime committed, which is the near theft of Graham's stamp collection.
Yes, the stamp collection. My first comment on Clive's family, every time we talk about them is, I am still bored by Clive's family. And then when the first thing that we learn about them, we learn about his brother in this run of episodes, is that he collects stamps, I'm like, yeah, that was...
Of course he does.
And she probably is a train spotter, and the daughter probably counts the thingies on a dandelion. That's who they are.
Well, she's a wheelbarrow horse hobbyist.
Well, yeah. I feel like there should be trigger warnings about discussing George the wheelbarrow horse.
Yes, well, RIP as well. So,
well, you've given that away, Sarah. I said we should have a trigger warning. The next thing you say is RIP. Could have built up to that bit gently. Like, okay, some of you really like the wheelbarrow horse, George. And it's terrible when things happen to people that we love, or indeed objects. But however, you like build up to it slowly.
Wheelbarrow horse got sent to live under a car.
Wheelbarrow horse went to a farm in the country where he can be free to roam the fields and have a happy life.
Also, he's dead. Anyway, before he dies, he becomes a source of conflict between Lucy and the other one.
Vicky and Lucy. When you read that, I wrote here, Vicky and Lucy catfight. And then I thought, that is such a Sun or Daily Mirror or something headline, or the Mirror headline. Vicky and Lucy catfight, and you'd probably be two models, you know.
Yeah, Vicky and Lucy wheelbarrow horse fight.
Wheelbarrow, it takes something away. And then we have Vicky versus the burglar in her house, who is in fact good fun Alex from the pub.
Yeah, not such a cheerful booze fairy now, is he?
No, and then he says that if she tells anyone that she's seen him trying to nick the stamp album, he'll kill her boring parents. And I'm amazed she doesn't go, brilliant, go for it. Maybe I'll have more of a chance because I'm the only one who's got any oomph in my family. But
yeah. And someone, I can't remember who it was, apologies, but we are an anonymous Facebook group, but the Leaving Erinsborough Facebook group, please do join. Please do agree to the group rules, because otherwise I have to decline you and then try again and agree to the group rules next time. I hate doing it. It's stressful. Just agree to the group rules, please. They're not complicated. But anyway, so basically I'm a rule follower, and also I don't want people to be dicks to each other. No. But someone in the group pointed out that this young actor is the little sister of the actor who plays Sue Parker,
right? What,
which is why they have the same bowl haircut. The actor who plays Vicky, the little girl,
yeah,
in real life, yeah, is the sister of Sue Parker, the actor who plays Sue Parker.
Wow, okay, that was such a fun fact.
Yeah. There we go. She's a very good little actor, and she does a great job being terrified of this guy who really, for a stamp collection, like going away for murder, seems quite high. You know what I mean? Like quite a high price to pay.
I mean, it depends how cool the stamps are. Like maybe one's from somebody's nana on holiday in Greece or something.
You don't understand, this is a penny black.
But it's also like, on his way out, he runs over fake wheelbarrow horse George, which is in the streets after the fight between Vicky and Lucy, cat fight. And I thought that, I've written it, that George wheelbarrow horse looked sadder than Jean when he got run over.
Everyone, I think they paid more attention to this death than they do to Jean's.
Yeah, seriously. Although still, and here's a quote for you, they don't call an ambulance, do they? They should call an ambulance for wheelbarrow horse. But Vic...
it's too late for wheelbarrow horse.
It is so sad. Vicky is really good at sinister little girl frightened of stuff acting.
Yes. Really, yeah, she's good. Got some proper shining acting going on.
Yeah, completely. Completely. And then she's telling everyone how scared she is. And they keep saying things like, she seems frightened of something. What, really? Which is, it's amazing, because she had just said she was scared. You are so perceptive.
Yeah, the parents are, on this street are top notch. And so Lucy knows the secret. So she tells Lucy the secret. And then Helen does a great job of extracting the secret from Lucy.
Yeah,
she's social worker levels of like, I have a friend who's going through this thing. Isn't that weird? And Lucy's like, whoa, what are the odds? I did not think Lucy was this stupid, but it works. And she tells Helen everything. And then Helen goes and handles it with the parents, which is absolutely the right way to do, to not confront the kid and make her clam up. And Graham's like, I'm going to go and beat it out of her. It's like, no, chill. Like, she's, and then they keep talking about like, if we handle this wrong, she could be traumatized. But like, at the moment, they're saying this behind her back, but later there's a scene where they just do this right in front of her face.
Yeah,
they're
like,
which is really like, she can't hear them. It's really odd. Anyway, we'll get to that. But they appoint Clive because Clive has training in such matters.
Yeah, when he was an intern, he got trained in extracting traumatic information from children. Even though he was, and I quote, a court jester. But I have got to tell you that I wrote something that looks like Gert Foster, and it's taken me until now to realise it was court jester because of the context. So yeah, Gert Foster, court jester. But yeah, so he has, none of us knew this, that when you train to be a GP, at some point as an intern, you become an expert in retrieving traumatic information from children, using the old school show me on the puppet technique.
I want to see this training. I do believe that you receive some sort of social work training or awareness training about abuse, maybe.
I'm not
maybe
sure
not
you
in
did
the 80s.
In 1987 or whenever. No, or now.
No, maybe, but you know, it makes sense now. Like, I've had GPs phone me for welfare checks because I always wear sunglasses to the GP surgery because I'm autistic and the light is really bright and my light brightness, my photosensitivity is a lot worse than most people. But they were like, why do we never see her eyes?
True.
And they thought I was like being abused, and they phoned and did a welfare check.
Wow. That's good.
Yeah, it's good. But like, luckily, you know, people are trained to look, and I was like, no, I'm just autistic and you have all the lights on.
Yeah. I've just been doing workshops this week in an amazing school called the Kisharon Noe School, which is an SEN school in North London. And they have in their classrooms adjustable lighting, because obviously for some kids at some points of the day, it's just too much to have like proper harsh classroom lighting. And they have, and they have a couple of classes where predominantly a lot of the students are autistic. And in that classroom, they have the lights are filtered to start with, I think. So they lose the glary, whatever the glary color is, and they have periods of the day where it's just calm. Like, I just thought that was brilliant. It was
that's
so
brilliant.
Nice.
I want to go to that school.
Yeah, I mean, they have sensory rooms, all that business as well. But I just think when you are in an environment, and this speaks to both of us, and I'm sure people listening, well, you're in an environment where the default setting is to cater for you. It's not an exception. It's quite amazing.
It really is. I mean, I have yet to. My own house is that environment, I guess. But outside of my house, it's very, very, very difficult. And, you know, people really make you feel bad. But anyway, this is a tangent, but whatever. I'm going right on a tangent about ableism in society. But okay, good on Clive. He's got the training. I want to see this training, because at first he does a good job, and then later on, it gets weird. Things get weird.
Really weird. Where he gives her a puppet and he's got a puppet, and the puppets can talk to each other. That is like a genuine technique, but the manner in which he carried out, with lots of stories which had metaphors and allegorical natures to them, was a lot.
But he's an artist.
He isn't just like, let's get the information. It's like, let's make a show. That's what it felt like. Your puppet and my puppet. But she does break. Like, he does manage to break her.
I like that, what's her name, Kate, is probably like, Clive, do you want to actually get the information out of her? He's like, quiet, this is my moment.
Listen.
I'm doing an accent.
Don't interrupt the puppet. And the accent was just, I think, on the safe side of racist. The accent, he did like a kind of, is it Spanish or is it just an accent that no one's ever used in real life?
I think if it's a generic accent that comes from nowhere, it's not racist.
Yeah, fair enough. That's what I mean. So, in fact, if anything, he was just appropriating an accent he's just invented.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Nothing to see here. He does this because, by the way, Graham gets the shit beaten out of him by Alex, because Vicky identifies him. And instead of calling the authorities, which don't exist in Erinsborough, he decides to confront Alex himself.
Well, the authorities do exist, because earlier they have, when she does the mini reveal of who came in the house, the most oblivious copper in the world goes to the pub and to ask questions. So they have met, you know, police do play a part in this. But then they have this plan, Clive's Warring Family. I don't bother giving them the names. They have this plan of being with Vicky all the time, so she's not too nervous, which is fine and fair enough, and good parenting, which is unusual in Ramsey Street. And so she goes to work with her daddy in his confidential office, where she could just hide in a side room while he presumably has appointments with his patients, and, you know, makes them pull up their tops so he can listen to
them. Daddy, what's a coil?
Yeah, what's wrong with that man? Anyway, so and then she confides in him that the guy in the waiting room is the burglar. What, not nice Alex from the pub? Yeah. And then he decides he's going to sort of confront him with no plan at all, no calling the police, even though there's a discussion about really you should call the police. No, you just go into that side room, little Vicky, while I have a absolutely unplanned intervention with the guy who threatened to kill me. And then, of course, the next thing we see is that he's on the floor, clearly in pieces. And at no point does anybody call an ambulance.
No. They haven't trained her for that. She's like, where's Clive? Clive? Oh, well.
Clive.
Yeah. Now, you wait here, Vicky. Daddy's going to go and get the shit beaten out of him, okay?
And don't worry. Because Uncle Clive will get you to talk all about it through the medium of puppets.
Yeah. Don't worry, because there's going to be a great puppet show later. It's going to be accents. And he's going to say in front of you now, this might not work, and I might traumatise her for life.
Yeah, can I have permission to please?
Yeah.
Oh, dear me.
She's right there. She can hear you. Oh, well. So Graham might die, then he doesn't die.
I was a bit sad.
Then, but the upshot is Kate quits her job. I think they're going to go back to the country after this because they keep talking about it. And Clive is going to take over the doctor's office. So I think this whole thing has been a plot device to get Clive back into doctoring.
Yeah, of course. But I would put it to you that he hasn't got up to date registration as a doctor. You know, you're like, you can't just qualify as a doctor and then not do anything with it for a few years and then just say, now I'm a GP again. You do have to maybe contact someone from some kind of medical board.
Yeah, it's not a driver's license.
No, or, you know, a library card.
I say, having just started driving again after a 6-year break, you can't just get right back in the car. No one's.
But yes. It's a bit like less life or deathy, but except for obviously depends on how you drive.
Well, very, very slowly and carefully. Anyway, there's a lot of anyways. I'm just moving right along. Alex is exposed. He's nicked some money from the pub. He's run off. They briefly blame biker girl. She's offended. Then whatever. Eileen,
bless her.
So Clive was left in charge of the cafe while Daphne and Des were on honeymoon, and he got distracted by his dead fiance's sister, and he just handed it over to Eileen, who has somehow like instigated some sort of youth revolt.
Yeah, because she's trying to filter out the noisy kids being normal kids. So there's a whole debate about it in the morning over breakfast, or Mike's having breakfast, Eileen's buffing around. And then there's one of those very cute interactions between Eileen and Michael where she's trying to get him to guess through hints that she wants him to put his plate in the sink, you know. And then his rebellion is to chuck the dishcloth into the plant pot. It was very cute. But because she's constantly telling the kids in the cafe, who are the ones who spend money and whatever, to be quiet, she turns down the jukebox, which we all know is a crime. And, it starts a massive riot with a threatening budding young journalist from the sixth form who wants to expose her terrible ways.
He also has a full name, but I can't remember what it was.
Greeny.
It's like Greeny. It's like John. No, it's John Green, isn't it? Because that's the same name as the author.
Oh, maybe. I didn't care. But I liked it when they started calling him Greeny. Greeny.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to make it sound like Greeny is threatening, but it doesn't sound like a threatening name. It's not a butch name.
It's not. Greeny. It's not Biff Dart's face. No,
exactly.
So there's this youth revolt going on. Daphne's trying to get her customers back. Clive's answer is jelly beans shenanigans.
The great jelly bean swindle.
Yes.
I mean, what a catchy name. And also, I'd say that if you include the word swindle in your marketing, very unlikely that anyone's going to go for your plan.
Yeah. Very unlikely. I haven't been swindled all week.
And also, it's like it's a weird competition. Guess how many jelly beans, and then you get free lunches for a week.
Yeah, and that's enough to ruin Daphne as well.
Well, she's already part ruined by the whole, jukebox debacle and Greeny and his protests.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it's like a protest that no one really would care about. Do you know what I mean?
No.
It was like the protest for the closing of Erinsborough High in Contemporary Neighbours because...
it turned into a riot. All these middle-aged people showing up to riot because their old high school is being closed.
Their old high school. Seriously. They could close my old high school tomorrow and... I would do like a JD from Heather's and light my cigarette from the burning embers. Although I don't smoke, but I would smoke for that.
I like how in your world, your high school being closed down, it also has to be burned to the ground. It's not enough to close it.
No, I don't know where that came from, a really deep place.
Oh, dear.
I think my next therapy session is going to be really interesting. And also in that, I'm not Winona Ryder. I'm Christian Slater. No, I am Winona Ryder. She does light it from him. I'm Winona Ryder. It's fine. Thank goodness.
I'd take either.
Yeah, sure.
She says bisexually. Anyway.
I think there was almost a pause there for you all when you're listening because we're both thinking about Christian Slater and Winona Ryder.
We are. We've gone places. Not
moving on.
Nowhere. Yeah, Noah, you need to hear about Jane. So poor sweet Jane.
So Jane.
Yeah. Because she's smart, she wears glasses, so she's got a big old target on her back. I identify with Jane. I understand young Jane, older Jane, not so much. But this Jane, this is a Jane I can get on board with.
Well,
so
this is setting up future Jane, isn't it?
Sure. And these are the origins of a relationship that is ongoing today, kind of via Skype, unless Mike leaves her for this Angela, whoever she is.
Angela, she's got a lot of mentions.
She did. He does have Angela mentionitis. I don't like it. No. But oh, Jane,
that moment where they says, "Oh, who's going to take her to?" She says to Mike, "Are you taking anyone to the school dance?" And I did have a little moment, a little flutter then of, "Oh, that's the beginning of all this."
Yeah, it's lovely, and he's completely obtuse. He's like, "Oh no." She's like,
haven't asked around to see who's really hot and gorgeous yet.
Oh, poor Jane. And so then Mrs. Mangle gives her great life advice, tells her that you have to dumb yourself down in order to be appealing to a man, because obviously men have fragile little egos and can't take a woman being more intelligent than them or being competition in any way.
It's a hideous speech. It's like, you're not as good as your mum. She was better at art than you, and you've stayed up making these pathetic posters, and you're really ugly. No one will ever be interested in you. So just pretend to be thick, because you know you've got nothing else to offer. And I have to say, like Daphne sort of says to Mike, "What's wrong with a girl who likes computers?" And his response is nothing, as long as she has the looks to match. It's really sad.
Oh, Mike. Horrible. Horrible, horrible, horrible boys.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's believable for the era and the age they're at, but, you know, you want better from Mike, don't you, just because he's Mike?
Mm. I do.
But, yeah, she does take Mrs. Mangle's advice and then gets punished for taking Mrs. Mangle's advice. Yeah. So poor Jane can't win.
And coming fourth out of, like, 90 people or something in a maths test. And then they all toast Mike for winning the maths test. It was a fix. And then they toast Jane for being a good loser. And that broke my heart.
Yeah. The whole thing is poor Jane. I mean, you know, we know where it's going, but I don't really know how it's going there because I haven't seen it. I just know, like, you know, glasses. But we won't spoil it in case anyone doesn't know what we're talking about for some reason. Are you sure you're in the right place? But yes.
Also,
anyway.
It's being very specifically signposted. And all I'm saying is that it isn't a surprise that I'm thinking about Greece in terms of the dance match, because this is also a Greece moment in terms of the lesson is change yourself for a man. That's a terrible lesson.
It is a terrible lesson. So that's where we leave poor Jane. She's humiliated by the whole thing. And Charlene's like, "Mike, are you dense? She wants you to take her to the dance." So that's kind of where we leave off with Jane. Have I forgotten anything or anyone? Because I just done this from memory this morning.
You've done a very, very good job.
Thank you.
I thought, I don't know. I've got some points. So if I make my
some point, Rachel's observations.
Rachel's observations.
Rachel's observations.
Then maybe they'll spur your memory if there's anything left. But I think we're basically there. So let me see. Some of them we've been through anyway. So first, like the first one here is that yet again, no one wants Scott to do any schoolwork. Scott is not allowed to do schoolwork. I feel like I've said that so many times. You know, Paul's saying, "No, you still have to do this, you have to do that." And Helen's going, "Yeah, let him do his homework. He's in HSC year." I think let him do his homework. That annoyed me. When it turns out that Eileen has in fact got new furniture arriving, Mrs. Mangle does the big reveal that in fact there are furniture delivery people heading towards the unit as we
speak. Yes, forgot about that.
Eileen does this amazing weird twitchy face into the camera. It was just the most beautiful. I mean, she's such an amazing actor. We've fangirl her acting all the time on this
show.
We
love her.
But her amazing new furniture twitchy face being caught out, I think, is worth a watch on its own. I'll see if I can find the exact moment, and then when the pod comes out, I'll put in the Facebook group where to find it. Helen has this whole conversation with Shane when he's thinking of taking some time off originally to go and see his dad and mum. I was going to say his dad and Maria because the relationship with the kids is not very maternal. And then he decides obviously he's going on the bike. But she tells him to take all the time he needs because he's got to make the biggest decision of his life. And I thought that was really funny because the biggest decision of your life, if you want to stay working for Home Janes or not, but when he got engaged or when anyone gets engaged, that's not the biggest decision of their lives because they do it on a whim after 20 minutes.
It's just another Tuesday.
Keeping somebody's baby, it's not the biggest decision of your life. This is the biggest decision of his life. Does he really want to stay working as a chauffeur or not? There's a really, for me, an amazing Neighbours moment when Madge and Helen are having their heart-to-heart about her predicament with the baby, because there's an actual steaming kettle with steam coming out of it that pours actual hot water into actual cups, and then Helen tea bags the water. That's the only way I can describe it. She's got these two tea bags on strings and she's just dunking them up and down. Who is that? How you make tea?
These actors have never done any form of housework.
It was so weird. She's just like holding them at the same height, like there's a Guinness World Records person monitoring, and she does like a certain number of dunks up and down, up and down, up and down, and then she just leaves them on the counter, which is very unlikely, I would say, for Helen, who likes everything to be immaculate. And that's when I got over it being actual hot water was the dunking. That's spectacular. There's a very silly moment with Shane and Paul where they find, in fact, it's Patty's bra in Jack Lasseter's crumbly caravan, and they describe it as a double-barreled slingshot, which I thought was I enjoyed
watching... Who was married? She's seen a bra.
Well, I enjoyed watching Clive making a new wheelbarrow horse George, like some kind of pound shop Tim Burton out of bits and pieces. You know, or like in Toy Story, the boy from next door who just cobbles bits of toy together to make creepy toys. So I didn't think that was
Sid,
that's exactly right. Yeah, and I didn't think that would be less frightening for Vicky, to be honest, to almost as Vicky, give her a more creepy looking pretend horse. I probably didn't need to sing. There's a conversation between Shane and Daphne where he describes their history as, once upon a time, you and I were pretty close. Were they not engaged?
Yeah.
That is pretty close.
Twice. No?
Well.
Almost engaged once and then actually engaged a second time.
I mean, which is nothing by Ramsay Street standards. But, yeah. Those are my observations, my specific observations for this. But I said I would tell you my third, a general observation about how TV shows and films work. So, thank you. I enjoyed that drum roll.
Thank you.
So now I'm trying to remember what the first one was. What was the first one?
Casualty.
That anytime anything's perfect, it's like an episode of Casualty. It's all about to go wrong. So you could just spot what's the thing that's going to disrupt. The second one is that if there's a covered up biker, it's always a woman. And the third one is, and this I have to attribute to my amazing friend who passed away during lockdown, Yael Lackmaker, who was a big film and TV buff, and she and I had lots and lots of brilliant conversations about shows that we enjoyed and whatever, and I miss her all the time. But Yael and I had a theory that every show at some point has a Breakfast Club moment, so where the characters get stuck in a place, just so that they can have the unavoidable conversations. So at some point in Neighbours, in this pod, there will be a situation, I'll remind you all of that fact, that every single show has at least one Breakfast Club moment. I thank you. Those are my pronouncements.
Fantastic. Okay, well, we are coming to the end of the show. So we traditionally kick somebody out who we feel deserves evicting from the street.
Mm-hmm. I can go and get you if you don't leave Aaron's bar now. Who?
So who are we going to get rid of this week?
Mangle. Get that Mrs. Mangle out. That terrible speech to her granddaughter. I mean, stick her on George the creepy wheelbarrow horse and fling a runda Alex the pretendy burglar's car.
I mean, my person should be Alex because he threatened a child and then nearly killed her parent, but villain's gonna villain.
Yeah.
I'm more angry with Charlene. Don't give your poor, long-suffering mother a fake grandchild, let her bond with it, and then be like, ah, that's psych, it's your ex-husband's love child. No, bad, bad Charlene, bad.
Bad Charlene. Oh, but if we lost Charlene and Mrs. Mangle, where would we be?
Present-day neighbours.
Yeah, true. without, and especially if Scott goes to find Charlene and then we don't have to hear his voice.
Well, that would be a tragedy. And we'll see you all next time.
Goodbye.
Leaving Erinsborough was hosted by Sarah Gibbs and Rachel Krieger. This episode was edited by John Gibbs. Our logo is by Hayley Charlesworth. Our theme song is mixed by Graham Rawson. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review wherever you get podcasts. Join us next time when we'll be covering episodes 321 to 330.